This is Lee Krivat. Welcome to Episode 7 of Climate Champions, the podcast series that focuses on the people that are helping to mitigate climate change, what they are doing, and why they are doing it. Karen Lefkowitz is my guest. She is the former VP at PHI, where she led Utility of the Future, as well as many other things. And now she's CEO of Sunset Energy, where she consults in the electric industry and tries to help mitigate climate change. Karen and I met in Brazil at one of IBM's Global Intelligent Utility Network Coalition meetings. Try saying that five times fast. Our spouses hit it off, and we ended up vacationing together in Rio, Amsterdam, Berlin, San Francisco, New York, and even Beijing. We've also done about a dozen panels together because folks like to hear us argue. If I don't embarrass her too much in this interview, the four of us are headed to Scotland in August for the Fringe Festival. James Henry Bedell, take it away. Welcome to Climate Champions. I'm Lee Krivat, and it is the eve of Distributech in New Orleans, or Nawlins. I don't know how to say it. And I have with me Karen Lefkowitz, and I'm going to let her talk about what she does now. But first, I'm going to ask you a different question. I was wondering if there were any specific moments that really made you feel like, I'm into this. I'm going to do something about it. This is important.
So the first time that I saw a report in the news about a glacier breaking off and sailing off and starting to melt, and I can't remember, it was like the size of Rhode Island or the size of Texas. It was something incomprehensibly big to me. And I kept thinking, you know, this should be the wake-up call. And then realizing that around me, very few people were thinking about how potentially catastrophic this was. And at the time, there were still people who were actively saying, this is something that the Earth goes through routinely, so this is a normal cyclical problem. And so I began thinking about how I could convince people. Well, first, I think how I could be certain that my perception was right, because I don't ever want to reject somebody else's point of view out of hand. And then more importantly, what could I do about it? I think at around the same time, there started to be a growing awareness of sort of a movement for energy efficiency. And there had been some charts that were showing how inefficient American homes were compared to some homes in Northern Europe. That's usually where they compare it to. And I had an opportunity to take a job that helped me reinforce energy efficiency in homes. And so it sort of started cascading, right? So one thing leads to another. So you first have this sort of epiphany that things are bad and maybe I could help get them better, but I have to learn more about it. Then you have an opportunity to have a job where you actually are paid to improve energy efficiency. And then in the course of that job, you start exploring and researching and learning. And so it just sort of grew from there.
I was on a cruise in Alaska where we were looking at the ice. And while we were looking at the glaciers, they were falling apart and falling into the water. You know, while we were there.
That's crazy.
Well, the person who worked for the ship, for the cruise line, said, I'm not allowed to give an opinion about climate change, but I will tell you this, that just a few years ago, there was a place where you could see this from and you didn't have to take a cruise ship, and it was 50 miles from here. So he said, while it is normal to have melting, you know, where it goes backwards and then forwards, it's not normal in this amount of time to go 50 miles.
Right. That's pretty extreme.
So while it is natural, that's not natural.
Right. You know, and there's another component to this. You know, it's not just climate change, but having sort of an ethic, a personal ethic around feeling responsible for your own environment and the planet around it. And that actually, for me, started, you know, way back in high school. I actually participated in the first Earth Day celebration and went out in our community and cleaned up the local stream. And then for years afterwards, that just became a normal thing. And you don't think about it, right? So it's a learned behavior. Then you fast forward and our son's growing up and he's in Boy Scouts. And they do a paper drive to collect newspaper to turn in for recycling long before, I'm afraid he's old enough that this was long before towns had recycling centers. And so you had to drive it to places. And it turned out that it wasn't a hard habit to get into. And so we just, as a family, continued it. And once a month, we'd take all our newspaper to a recycling center. That was probably 5 or 6 years before the city started even talking about public recycling. So even before you thought about or think about climate change and what you can do, there's some, just an ethical sense that you should be responsible about resources in general.
When you think about climate change and you want to explain to others that it's important, like you just explained to me the ethical responsibility, what do you say to convey that message?
So I heard a fact that astonished me, and it was probably 2 years ago, where the local weather reporter said, children that are 15 years old today have never seen an average winter or an average summer. That over the course of time, the average has changed so dramatically because we're measuring, they create the average measured over so many years that it's significantly different than the average for the last, say, 10 years or 15 years. And so all those stories about really, really heavy snows or really hot summers are different if you're a kid today than if you're our age and remembering things.
You're seeing a lot of those things.
I see a lot of that all around me.
Yes.
Yeah. So sometimes when I use that fact because I think it's, I think that that's very relatable. You know, everybody grew up with stories about I had to walk through 2 feet through the snow for 5 miles uphill both ways. Yeah. So we all have this vision of what things were like, and it's just a tangible way of saying to people, your kids aren't going to experience that. Their experience is going to be almost foreign to the one that you had.
So that almost answers this question, but even deeper, why is it personally important to you?
It's important to do what you can. I mean, it's sort of like saying, why do the right thing? Because it's the right thing to do. It's not hard to know what the right thing to do is in any given situation. What's hard is if you have to inconvenience yourself to do that right thing. And so, for example, you know, I really admire people who bike everywhere they can. They don't have to drive at all. I'm not going to do that. That is not a habit I'm about to take, and the distances I would have to bike are too far. So I did the next best thing, and I bought an electric vehicle, so that I can contribute that small thing. The why, I mean, I could say it's part of my cultural heritage, right? I'm Jewish. We believe in the concept of tikkun olam, which is to heal the world, and that's a big part of the way I view the world and the way I view my responsibilities as part of it.
You started to also talk about this before, and I'm glad you didn't go too far into it, because I'd like you to go more in depth about your career and climate change and how that intersection evolved.
Yeah, it's actually an interesting story. You know, a lot of people are more purposeful about their career than I was. So I started out as a computer programmer. I worked for the New York Federal Reserve Bank, and I did work in real-time systems for the Fed. Then I had an opportunity, I sort of got tired of being in New York, and I had an opportunity to return to Washington, D.C., which is where I went to college, and work for Pepco. They needed a computer programmer for a computer system that was the same system that we were using at the Fed. And I took it and moved back to DC. And so I was a computer programmer for the energy management system, which managed the transmission and distribution systems for Pepco. I started there in 1979, so it goes way back, and eventually rose to be the director of system operations for all of Pepco and then for all of PHI. So it was Washington, D.C., the Maryland suburbs around Washington, Delaware, and southern New Jersey. It was a very rewarding job. But you also got to see the impacts of extreme weather. So we have to go through hurricanes and you have to deal with restoration. You're talking to a lot of people all the time. We were always in, as everyone in the industry knows, with mutual assistance, we were always in close communication with utilities that needed support in other places. We paid a lot of attention to Florida the year that they had, the year of Katrina. They had four hurricanes back to back. Actually, it may have been the year before Katrina. And so I started to have a real awareness of the impacts of extreme weather on infrastructure and how infrastructure fared. So from that job, I ended up getting into a job in our customer care organization running the energy efficiency program. And that was what I was alluding to before, which was, like many utilities, you're encouraging customers to conserve through the use of demand response functions. And so by using a demand response device, we could operate a customer's hot water heater or their heat pump or their air conditioning unit to conserve during particular times of the year. In our service territory, the hot water heaters weren't particularly useful. And so we focused almost exclusively on heat pumps and central air conditioners. We also I got to see the really dramatic change that we had. I mean, the number of megawatts that we could curtail during a hot day, on a peak day, was pretty significant. And when you think about it, you can call these events, you start to have an understanding of, you're lowering a thermostat by a couple of degrees, or raising it, in the case of the air conditioner, a couple of degrees, the really compounding effect of that energy savings. It also made me aware of how inefficient most of our homes are. And so one of the other programs that I administered was a program that offered rebates for people if they did improvements to their home that qualified for those rebates, as well as getting a whole house audit, energy audit. And of course, I did that on my own home, and I did all those energy efficiency upgrades on my house and saw the tremendous impact it had on my energy usage. So that job segued into the job that sort of, I would say, was sort of a capstone. And that was, I actually ran our AMI program and installed just about 2 million
AMI,
advanced metering infrastructure. I installed about 2 million meters. We had a really excellent execution. I had an amazing team. And through that, we started to get a real insight into usage and how people used energy and sort of plotting their graphs rather than using the average that we all use for everything in energy accounting, to use the actual and the kinds of changes that can make. I also spent a lot of time then talking to customers about how to use that data. And I had to, it was very controversial. You may remember, it was very controversial to roll out AMI in certain communities. And one of the problems that we had was we had to get recovery for this investment after the installation in the state of Maryland. And they were going to be incredibly critical of what we did, because they would look to, particularly People's Council, would look to exclude as much of the cost as they could, right, to prove that we weren't meeting the goals of the program. And so we were keeping incredibly good records and meticulous records and speaking to folks about their usage. And one of the things that we did was collect stories that customers told us. And there were a couple of stories that have always stuck with me, but one that, two that really I recall and will never forget is a woman who called us complaining, saying there's something wrong with this meter because I'm looking at the data and it shows a spike every day at about 3:30, and the only one home is my son. He's home after school for a couple hours before we get home. And, you know, we ran some tests and we went out and we tested the meter and we said, everything is all right. I mean, that spike is happening weekdays at almost the same time every day. And she was really angry and she went away. We didn't hear anything. And a couple of weeks later, she called back to tell us that she found out that her son was inviting all of his friends over and they were all plugging in their games when they got home. And it wasn't a huge draw, but it was discernible. And so it explained her peak or the spike and enabled her to take action to change it if she wanted to.
I have a different AMI story. A woman called up and she said that the meter is beeping now. It's intermittent beeping. It's driving her crazy. Get rid of this meter. And they went out and they said, you know, there's no speaker in the meter, so it cannot beep. It can't be that. But she was very insistent. They eventually found that in the wall, there was a smoke alarm. And it had some point before the woman took ownership of the home fallen into the wall, in the wall. But the battery lasted for a long time. But now the battery needed to be replaced. So that was the beeping.
Oh, my God. Yeah. Well, the other story that was, I thought, also very instructive for the customer and provided us a great opportunity to provide good service to that customer was they called and they said, look, our bill, it was a heating bill, has skyrocketed. I mean, it's just something's wrong and nothing has changed and you guys have to take this meter out because I'm sure it's the meter's fault. And we looked at the data and sure enough, they had really high spikes and a big difference month over month. And we said, look, it all corresponds to heat. And she correctly said, it's never been this high, ever. And so we sent a technician out to her house. And what we discovered is she had replaced her heat pump and they didn't install it correctly. And she was running on the emergency heat instead of the heat pump, which I know you don't have this problem in San Diego, but it meant that she was running essentially on radiant heat the whole time, and that was a crazy expensive way. And so, of course, she got her contractor to come back, and whether she ever got a rebate from that guy, I can't tell you. But we also had a woman who discovered her husband was having an affair at their beach property because she was complaining about the usage and nobody was down there. And she called us back.
Oh, somebody was down there.
Oh, somebody was down there. Oh, yeah. And she called us back to tell us about it because she was so angry at him. So it's not only...
So it is used for spying. They were right. The opponents were right.
Yeah, we do use it for spying. Yeah.
So talk about electric vehicles and solar and how you in your job or out of your job were able to make that more of a success.
So I am a big fan of renewable energy and I'm an even bigger fan of electric vehicles. So I mentioned earlier I have one. I have a Chevy Bolt with a B. I get about 200 miles a charge, 230 miles per charge when I'm not, you know, being heavy-footed, which is rare. But anyway, it's a great car and it's a fun car. The company has tried very hard and is working with all of the regulators in its various jurisdictions to provide more EV infrastructure. You know, Pepco was fortunate that we operated in two ZEV states, zero emission states, that are have goals. I believe it's in 2025 or something like that for a certain number of zero emission vehicles. And so we were able to sort of piggyback on those regulations to offer tariffs that reduce the charging cost for vehicles overnight. That's what I take advantage of. I mean, my cost to charge my car has never been more than $25 a month because the rate is so low overnight when I charge. And then also trying to find innovative ways to install more charging infrastructure in the community. You know, I think that as much as anything, being an evangelist about electric vehicles is important. There are a lot of misinformation and misconceptions about the way EVs operate out there, including some of the drawbacks, or not drawbacks, but limitations. So again, not a problem you have in Southern California, but in my neck of the woods, you lose about 20-25% battery efficiency in the winter. And so you need to be aware of that and just knowledgeable. And so you have to know where chargers are if you're going to travel long distances. But as I explained to people, the vast majority of trips are very short and you're charging at home and it's really easy. Now, individual cars are the first step, but the second, third, and fourth steps of transportation electrification are much more exciting. You know, school buses, and city buses are an easy win for electrification. They have short trips. They're short in duration and in distance. The average school bus goes 80 miles in a day. So there's a big opportunity there. The same is true of city buses. We're looking at opportunities in ports. You know, it's something you don't really think about. Big ships pull in. They're hooking up generally to some kind of diesel. They're running diesel to provide the services when they're in dock. And it's really nasty. And a lot of ports are now electrifying and offering some kind of incentive to the ship owners because they're going to have to actually put in some effort on their part. But there's a big opportunity to save for them and for the environment.
I am smiling right now because a number of times you said we are.
Oh.
By we, do you mean you and Pepco?
Well, so that's probably more the royal we from an industrial perspective, because I did leave Pepco about 9 months ago, and I operate independently, and I'm partnering when appropriate with Lee Cravat. You might know him.
I know that guy. Let's not talk about that.
But I do think that one of the opportunities that I've had since leaving my job is to have more of a longer-term perspective, because every company is interested in the next, whatever their time horizon is, whether it's a quarterly look or an annual look. Regulators and legislators have the same thing. So being outside of that gives me an opportunity to talk to industry groups and regulators about what the long-term could be and what the long-term could look like. And it's also really exciting to be able to communicate to people about things that are being experimented on. So take the long view. Inductive charging for city buses is something that I think is a really cool idea. Inductive charging for general vehicles on highways and at rest stops is another thing that's looming. They're not ready for prime time yet, but they're certainly getting there. It's sort of like Tesla's roof tiles. They're not quite ready for prime time, but it's an interesting idea.
I know somebody that is redoing their roof, and they really wanted to use those tiles, and they're very bummed
that
they can't.
Yeah.
They can, just not in the timeline of rebuilding.
And if roof. I could do anything and rewind the clock a little, and I said this once, a CEO of another utility got really, really angry at me when I said it, because he said we didn't know about solar energy at the time, and it was cost prohibitive. All true. So I'm not saying this to put to have a negative comment about any utility's decisions, but if 25 years ago we had, as an industry, invested in utility-scale solar, we would be much further along the journey than we are today. So one of the things that I literally just learned today, because I was looking at a TED talk from 2012 by a physicist who was talking about the amount of physical space we would need in various countries, he was speaking specifically of England, to completely fuel the country with renewable sources. And the upshot was, there isn't enough space. There literally is not. If you blanketed 100% of the surface area of the UK, you could not produce enough solar or wind to provide all of the resources that they needed. And so you have to be creative in looking at these solutions. He said, look, I'm not a proponent of any one thing. I'm a big fan of renewables. He actually sounded an awful lot like me. And he said, but I'm a much bigger fan of arithmetic. And you know, you just do the numbers and it won't work. But you can do things by adding, like nuclear energy would really help offset that. And so it was kind of interesting. It was an interesting discussion.
The UK is interesting that way because of their size and their density. The United States is a bit different, but there are some parts of the United States,
right,
it would be very difficult, and other parts would not be very difficult.
Right. So we would have to, and this is, it's an interesting trade-off because we could build solar farms and wind farms, and we are starting to see them being built in more rural areas in the center of the country that aren't particularly good for agriculture. Because we have to remember, we can't offset all the agricultural land either. You know, that's still sort of necessary for us as human beings to live. But that's going to require construction of transmission lines. And one of the hardest things to do in the utility industry is to build a new transmission line. The sole exception to that is if you're in the state of Texas, where they've got all this wind in the west and their load is in the east, and they built a couple thousand miles of transmission because it's all inside one state boundary.
What is interesting to me, and this is what I think, and maybe I'm wrong, and everybody who listens to this program, I think we're up to 8 listeners, are going to tell me. But I think that you said utilities were late getting into solar because they didn't know. I think that if regulators and legislators and people and utilities all lined up and said, oh my God, we don't have a lot of time left to do something about climate change, I think utilities are back in the game. I think they're back in the game with renewables on a large scale, and I think they're back in the game with transmission. I don't know who's going to build it, but the utilities that bid the best price for it, whatever the rules might be, but I don't think it'll be as hard to build when everybody is lined up about the importance of it.
Okay, so, sure.
If that happens.
If everybody agreed.
I'm not saying that's going to happen.
Right, if everybody agreed, it would be simple. But here are the realities. The regulators don't necessarily understand the way utilities make money. The regulators don't necessarily understand the industry. The average regulator is got less than 3 years tenure in the job. And they aren't engineers coming out of the power industries. They're generally attorneys and other people, and particularly in the East and the West where they're appointed, where they're government appointees, as opposed to some parts of the Midwest where they're elected. But they don't have industry experience. And just about the time they figure out what's going on, they're leaving office. So even if they're well-intentioned, the likelihood of them getting really big changes done across a lot of opposition is very limited. The other big problem we have is utilities still make most of their money by installing infrastructure. So they're not earning money because they're figuring out how to get people to use less energy. They're earning money because they're building things. And so there is a move around the country to change that. We're talking about whether it's decoupling rates or actually changing what they call an asset for investment purposes. But it isn't something that's going to happen overnight. And the other problem that we have is that just human nature, everybody thinks somebody else is going to solve the problem. There are very few people who say, this is my problem, I'm responsible for helping solve it. There are very few people who do that.
I agree with you, but I was at the World War II Museum the past couple of days. I went 2 days because I couldn't get through it all, and there were many amazing things and scary and sad things about it. One of the impressive accomplishments during the war was the United States' capability to go from producing very few armaments and equipment, vehicles, transport, to being able to just pump out the planes,
right,
and pump out the weapons. Not saying I want a bunch of weapons, but if if there was an emergency that people understood was an emergency and was a matter of life and death,
right,
we might be able to marshal the forces of the country, of the world, and take on the challenge a lot faster than we are today.
Yeah, yeah. So you're talking about the will to change, and if we all are united around a single thought, you're right. I think that we live in a country that could rise to the challenge, but I haven't seen any evidence of people being willing to do that yet.
I don't think it's going to be anytime soon.
So I will say, I will reflect on one interesting thing. When I was in Beijing at the Smart Grid conference in Beijing, all of the...
I was once at a Smart Grid conference
in Beijing. I think it was the same one. All of the Chinese engineers were talking about how the Smart Grid was a tool for them to change the direction of climate change. They were all talking about it in terms of energy efficiency. And I came away from that, I was just astonished by that, because we had done all kinds of surveys. We had seen big consulting houses that provided us some data that said people are less interested in environmental reasons and more interested in personal financial reasons. And so they will change to save money. They won't change because it's the environmentally right thing to do. So they used to call them greenies. And they were the smallest of the four quadrants of all of the customer segmentations that did. I think things have changed from then somewhat, but I still think money talks.
I definitely think money talks until there's something more important than money. And in China, when we were there,
that's right,
my eyes were burning
the whole time,
and I was coughing, and I was not the only, I was in the majority.
Right.
Of people that were having all kinds of respiratory issues. And outside, children were wearing masks and they were playing basketball,
right,
while walking, because they weren't allowed to exercise hard because of the air quality. So when you're living in that world, perhaps that becomes more important than money.
Yeah. One of the things that I remember that was also very significant on that trip is to get a picture, like a photo of yourself with a blue sky background, they would have these big giant screens with a blue sky painting on it that you could stand in front of, because that was the only way you could get that kind of picture in Beijing.
So if that was your world, you might reorder your priorities a little bit.
Right. And your comments about people uniting around a single goal make sense, because in China we're seeing that they are making really big strides in solving their immediate climate problems. And it was heartening, right before the Olympics, you remember, China shut down the factories along close by the venues,
they
the Olympic
it to
venues.
Look good, even though it
wasn't right,
to good.
Improve
yeah.
to improve things. And it did. It improved things pretty quickly.
I think they also forced rain beforehand to
did
clean
they?
Things up a bit. I believe so. A little bit of
oh, that's
weather manipulation.
That's interesting. But, you know, I try not to be pessimistic. I live in a community which I think is pretty progressive about it. And you see a fair amount of installed rooftop solar, even though that's like the most expensive way to reach the kind of change that we want to get. It's at least an indicator that people cared enough to take that step. And we're starting to see lots and lots of electric vehicles on the road. And so we're seeing in local communities, people are responding. In fact, while the federal government seems to have stalled and not moving forward on anything related to protecting and preparing for climate change, we're starting to see individual cities take action. And Boston has invested billions, I don't even know how much, to raise their seawalls in the city. Cities in Florida are likewise taking actions.
So you can either pay for those seawalls for infinitum, or you
right.
could do something about what's causing this to happen.
Well, I
think in the end, the bill's less if you pay it up front. Not that they can deal with what has already happened.
Yeah, I'm afraid that we're running out of choices. I think that we may have to do both.
I would like to see us do both instead of just react.
Right, right.
So you talked about a CEO that got mad at you for what you said. Were there any significant setbacks in your career because you do speak your mind?
So let me just mention that that CEO was not anyone I ever worked for. So if you're listening, it wasn't you.
No one's listening. I don't have any CEOs listening to this podcast.
You know, I didn't. I was incredibly fortunate. You know, when I ran system operations, I was the first woman in the country who ever run a control room in system operations. I didn't work for people that ever judged that as a barrier. In fact, you know, being a woman may have been a advantage at that particular moment in history. I think that the only barrier that I can say I've run into is the number of senior executives that thought climate change was as much of a problem as I did was smaller than I would have wished for. And so we did an offsite program on sort of smart grid for the executive leadership team one year. And it was about five years ago. And at the end of that whole day, what I wanted to get people to believe was the platform was burning and burning fast, right? So we did this survey beforehand, like how many people think the platform is burning, and you know, maybe 30 or 40% said they didn't. At the end, we said, how many of you think it's burning a lot faster than you thought? And like 75% thought that. So I feel like by spending a day presenting information and data and trends, we were able to convince people that the current utility model wasn't going to last forever, right? You can't sustain the kind of business model that we have when it's colliding with the kind of economic and environmental and legislative and regulatory forces it's starting to hit. So appliances are much more efficient. We have flat to reducing loads. Even electric vehicles coming on aren't going to make up the difference. And it's all happening at about the same time our infrastructure is, the large large amounts of our infrastructure need to be upgraded or replaced. And so the traditional model of building traditional distribution assets are being challenged by regulators and advocacy groups to instead use renewable energy resources, so a combination of solar and batteries. Instead of building a substation, we're starting to hear that more and more. And so at some point, the utility's got to say, look, if I can't build stuff and earn, you've got to let me earn some other way or we're going to go out of business, right? So we already see, I mean, unfortunately, what happens when a utility has it facing bankruptcy, right? So Pacific Gas and Electric just filed.
First climate change driven bankruptcy.
Right. And so it's not unheard of. It's now line of sight. It may be further away, and I think I've said this to you before, I think the utilities in California are probably facing the cliff, and the utilities in the East and the Midwest see the cliff in the distance, but we're all going to hit it. So the business model that we have isn't sustainable over the long run. The climate change is coming. It's going to impact our business, whether it's in infrastructure replacement or in the case of extreme weather, infrastructure repair and replacement from storm damage is real, and it's going to be a giant problem for us to solve.
So given that, what is your vision of the future of energy for this country and or for the world?
So I think about it in a lot of different ways, but one way is you think about the regulatory model, right? So I think T&D companies, so right now, whether we have decoupled rates or not, we are still a volumetric business. And I think more and more utilities are going to look to moving away from a volumetric business. I think that they're going to look at pricing by square foot or some other model, and it'll look more like your cable TV bill than the current volumetric price. I think that that's going to change, and I think it's going to start to change pretty quickly. I think that the other thing that's going to happen is legislatures are going to start imposing on the regulatory process because the regulators just can't get through it all quick enough. I mean, the typical regulatory process takes too long for simple things. So to think about going through the kind of work they're trying to do in New York or the things that they've done in California, and we're years just to get through regulatory process, then you have to start implementing and building out and bidding. And so I think more and more we're going to look at legislatures doing something different, and it's going to come from states that are leading in the challenges of climate change.
That's
first.
A big prediction that you think legislators are going to take a piece
well,
of.
Well, I think that they've already started doing it. So in California, we've started to see things happening. I also think electric vehicles are clearly going to reach a point in the tangent and take off. I think that's coming very soon. One of the Super Bowl ads today is going to be a plug-in, I can't remember, it's an Audi? A plug-in Audi, I think.
Because that worked so well for the Leaf.
Yes. And so we're starting to see that the car manufacturers are getting in front of this. That will drive advertising and that will drive consumer behavior.
And I have no doubt that the electric vehicle movement is growing hard and will continue to grow harder.
Right. It only takes 15 years to replace a fleet.
My wife was not excited about the idea of going electric. And she resisted it for a while. But when she was driving, it was a RAV4 EV. And she could be in an SUV and basically off a stoplight. And she did do this. It was some sports car, maybe a Porsche, which just blew him off the lights. She liked that. And she just likes the control, the ability to accelerate when you need to accelerate, the quietness of it. And now she would not go back. I mean, I've felt that, like that from the beginning, but she's with me now. We both drive electric, and that's just how it's going to be.
Yeah, so we don't both have electric, but sometimes we have to fight over who's going to get to drive the electric.
And I think more people will realize that, and it'll just, and the cost will come down. So I think that's going to significantly move the needle.
Yeah, I think that we still have to solve the problem of the cost of batteries. And that'll come down, but not quick enough. I think that's probably the biggest barrier. There's still, the car companies are still subsidizing the cost of those cars.
Storage is where it's at.
Yep. It's all about storage. And that's the interesting thing. So you asked for predictions for the future. 10 years ago, people were predicting breakthroughs in storage that haven't come about. So if
it's come down a lot.
It's come down
a
lot.
In the last 10 years.
Yes, but it's still crazy expensive when you think about the scale you need to solve some of the problems that we're talking about.
I agree. It's still too expensive.
And so one of the things that's probably the single biggest challenge that we have to overcome as a technical challenge is how are we going to get the kind of storage that we need when you don't have, a waterfall nearby to help solve it?
Yeah. Do you have any questions for me?
Yeah, what do you think the biggest challenge is?
You said it, and I agree. I think the biggest challenge...
You think it's storage?
It's long-term storage. So I think short-term storage to manage grid quality or the quality of your microgrid, I think is very doable. You combine it with renewable energy and maybe some not renewable energy, and you can balance all that with the storage that exists today. But I think long-term storage is a huge issue. In some regions, you make twice as much energy during the summer months, the longer days, than you do during the winter months. So that means you have a lot of extra in the summer and not as much in the winter. Certainly my solar in my house, that's what I see year in and year out. You have to somehow be able to bottle that up. And of course, I don't mean with a bottle, but you do have to store it.
Right.
And using energy to turn carbon into natural gas, which is a great form of storage, especially when it comes from carbon that you're pulling out of the atmosphere. There's been a lot of talk about hydrogen and taking excess electric when it's available and making hydrogen out of it. And I think those things are all possible, but I'm not saying that's what's going to happen. We need something like that to cross a price barrier, I believe.
So there is one other area that we haven't talked about as a really big challenge coming up. And that is currently when you operate a part of the grid, you have, or historically, you had visibility into all the generation and all the load, right? And so the ability to balance that using the advanced energy management systems that we've had was developed over many years, but it required having that visibility. In the new world that we're in today, we don't have visibility into the sources of generation. And I don't know, and I've said this for a couple of years now, I don't know when there's enough behind the meter generation to be a problem from a grid management perspective, but I know there is a number. I don't know if it's 5% or 10% or I just don't. I'm sure there's a power engineer out there that could do it. But I do know
there is
that,
not.
Okay.
I do. Because I've asked a lot of them and they don't know what
they don't know.
Specific percentage.
But I do know that.
It actually has to do with how close they are to the substation and how.
It all
there's a lot
things,
of factors.
A lot of variables.
Yes.
And so what I do know is that today we have the most secure and the most stable electric system in the world. We as an industry, we know how to make it work. We don't know how to make it work in a future state where we don't have visibility and there's a degree of intermittency and we don't have the storage problem solved. And so there is some period of time where things are going to be dicey if that behind the meter generation grows enough before the storage stuff solves the problem of intermittency.
So I think that the storage we have can deal with the intermittency. I worked for PICE. I believe they can do it. I believe others can do it. And I don't think it's as out there as it needs to be. I believe that we are going to be able to tackle that problem. My bigger question is all these things are coming at one time. All these changes are at one time. And
right.
Will we all get on the same page? I believe from a technology perspective, we can solve it. I don't know if we can solve it from everybody agreeing and doing it.
Yeah, I think that one of the things that you have to keep in mind is we already have a certain amount of installed capacity out there. And so I don't know how I go knock on every customer's door that already installed solar behind the meter and say, here, put this device or add this software or do the whatever the technical solution is so that I have visibility into something that you bought and paid for and put on your roof. Because that's the kind of thing that we're talking about. Now, I agree. It's solvable at some point in time. And maybe we never have to go back and retrofit. Maybe that's done and gone. And
small potatoes is what I say.
Small potatoes. Maybe. Maybe.
I'm going to wrap this up now. And I'm going to wrap it up with a wrap. Well, the kids today, there's something that they missed. They never had average weather because it no longer does exist. Infrastructure. You learned about restoration and you want to do it with technology innovation. We didn't do solar because we didn't know, but don't worry out there, that wasn't Karen's CEO. You learn to understand usage, and I will tell you why, because of the data from 2 million AMI. Listen, I know that your foot isn't heavy, but you're still benefiting from states that are zevy.
That was good. Really, you did that on the fly.
I think our Scotland trip is safe. We booked the B&B, so it better be. My buddy and experienced podcast advisor, David Canyon, explained the benefit of marketing to me after listening to my first 6 episodes. Dave's podcast, Dumbing It Down with Dave, has over 100 episodes. Give it a try. So here goes. If you are enjoying the Climate Champions podcast series, please subscribe, rate it 5 stars, and tell all your climate concerned friends. Also, if you have any questions or comments, head to my website at www.crevatenergyinnovations.com and send me an email. Also, check out one of the cool new electric vehicles Karen and I were discussing. You'll love it, and you'll be helping to mitigate climate change.